Now, to help us listen and see, we're going to use these forms of the Tree of Life and the Tarot to help us to look into our own nature. So I want to start really by just talking about the Tarot
and the tree.
And I'll just send this. I've given this before, but I just want to make sure everybody's got a copy of it, so I'll just send this round. Some of you may have it already, there's a copy for everybody, so if you have, don't worry, there's a... Okay, I'll come back to it in detail in a moment. But first of all, I want to talk about the Tree of Life, where it comes from, Western esoteric tradition as well, in a way. The trees are just amazing things. We just start off first of all with the idea of a tree. You know, look outside the windows; they're just all around us. There are these images of completeness and of life and growth. They're these great balanced forms as well, because they have this enormous root structure, and then they have a trunk, and then they have this kind of the branches, and then they have this cycle really of growth, of coming into leaf, of flowering and fruiting, and in a way most human societies have in different ways used the image of a tree as a representation of the universe. Northern tradition, you get the great tree of Yggdrasil. In Iraq you get the tree of the genie. In Western Europe, you get the various versions of the tree of life. You get it in Islam. It's the tree planted in paradise. There's the olive tree. So we get this orientation towards the image of the tree as something that represents the whole of the universe to us, and in a certain way can represent also our own soul. And in a sense, really, Kabbalistic tradition, the tradition of the Tree of Life, really is based upon this idea that contemplating the image of the tree brings us into alignment with the universe and brings us into alignment with ourselves. One of the very earliest versions of the Tree of Life you get comes out of ancient Egypt. It's the great tree of Heliopolis. And it's the tree of the beginning. The other thing that you have with most of these images of trees and in these esoteric traditions is it connects us to the root energy of life, the energy of beginningness. You know, so Genesis, for example, the book of Genesis in the Bible begins with the word Bereshit, in the beginning. In ancient Egypt, they talk about Zeptepi, the first time. Now they're talking not just about historical beginning, but about a state of awareness and being that where everything is kind of made new, everything is connected to new possibility. So the experience of working with the Tree of Life, working with images, is intended to connect us to a source of life and energy that makes everything, that renews everything, refreshes everything. And in ancient Egypt, they have this image, very like the Genesis imagery, of the deep waters of the beginning, where everything is formless and like chaos, not shaped. They call it the waters of the Nun. And out of the waters, dry land emerges, the primal mound. And on that mound, the first thing that emerges is the great tree of Heliopolis. And it is this tree, really, that in various ways gives birth to all the forms of life. This is the tree with 10,000 leaves, and the Egyptian legend has it that each of us is a leaf of that tree, and if we contemplate that tree, we will find a leaf with our own name written upon it. Now, it's a powerful kind of poetic thing, really, of saying that we are connected to the deep life of the universe, and that we matter. Our own place in the tree of life is like no other beings. And if we contemplate that, it takes us into can take us into some very challenging areas, because if we have our own place on the tree of life, so does Donald Trump. So does Boris Johnson, currently more challenging, up front and challenging. But everybody does. So it's a profound image of interconnection and of the necessity to embrace the wholeness of life. It's not an easy, you know, at first it can be quite a beautiful pastoral kind of image. But as we find and relate to our own place in it, then it means we have to start relating and finding our own place in relationship to everything else. Much more challenging. The other image that is connected to it, though, is of the idea of the cycle of life, of just where the tree, as a tree sheds its leaves and puts out new leaves in each year, it goes through the whole cycle of beginning, of coming into maturity, of flowering in that place, of then creating fruit and the harvesting of fruit, and then finally returning into silence and death before putting out new life again. So the other aspect of contemplating a tree, any tree, is to find ourselves relating to that kind of cycle. And if we are part of that, of the tree of life, then of course we are part of that cycle. That cycle is constantly moving within us. The other aspect of the tree, in a way, that it is fractal, the forms of a tree repeat themselves at different levels. So also with us. So we can see the cycle of a day, we can see the cycle of a year, we can see the cycle of a life. So one of the things that happens, in a way, as we contemplate, as we create a defined space and look into the center and place an image there, that image comes to life, that image starts to talk back. So as we start to, as I have just done really, is to place the image of a tree before us. And as we contemplated the tree in the middle of the space, we then start, the image takes form and substance and starts to communicate to us. Now, theoretically, that's all we ever really need to do. Create a space, be still, allow some form to arise in the middle of the space, and then enter into conversation with our own soul and the soul of the universe. Straightforward, really. Not so much. And partly I want to look at really why it's not. Why it's not is because we get interrupted, we get sidetracked, we hit dead ends, we step outside the contemplative space. We find it hard to link the contemplative space maybe to the spaces of action and relationship in our life. And in a way, you know, it's It's interesting when you look at maps of spiritual progress. They're lovely maps of spiritual progress. Normally, if they're well worked out, they've got, and in fact, I'll be explaining one in a little while. It's got they seem to have stages, and you know, you do this, and then you can do that, and then that happens, and this happens. And they're great. They're helpful. They give us a direction and an orientation. But as they say, the map is not the territory. The map points us in a direction within the territory. Because actually, the real territory of spiritual growth, or just of life, really, is wandering around in circles, going back on yourself, falling over, getting up, kind of heading off in completely the wrong direction for days on end, then having to backtrack. And it's much more like a sort of tangled ball of wool, really, eventually, if we hold to the thread, which is the thread of awareness, eventually we find our way into something. What I'm going to suggest to you, in a way, is that in this weekend, as we're looking at the deepest parts of ourselves, that deep within us, right at the heart of our being, there is a deep awareness that operates with the capacities of will and imagination and embodiment, and that is constantly in dialogue with ourselves, constantly seeking to help us find our way. And in a way, the usefulness of the various forms we will be looking at is that they can remind us of that and place us in a situation where we can directly perceive that. Now, the title given to this workshop is The Footsteps of the Fool. Now, the Fool is the first of the major trumps of the tarot. There's various depictions of it, but probably the most common is of a young man about to step off a cliff with a dog jumping by his side, and we don't know, is the dog playing with him, is the dog biting his bottom, is that he, you know, he's often looking up like he's kind of doesn't know quite what he's doing, and it's a mysterious card, the Fool. In a way, it represents the mystery of beginning, of stepping over the edge. And in some ways, the carefreeness of the Fool, the lack of artifice, the lack of construction, represents a kind of a quality within the heart, a quality of love and trust and freedom. The other side, or we could say the shadow side of the Fool, is foolishness. Of blundering, of irresponsibility, of being daft, creating chaos, not caring, making it up as you go along. Back with Boris, I fear. But as with all deep archetypes, shadow and light are always connected somewhere. So within spontaneity, there, of course, is the possibility of folly. But within folly, there is the capacity to touch that kind of deep spontaneity. Because in a sense, the Fool is genuinely the wild card. I mean, the Fool, it's interesting, the Fool is the only one of the major tarot, of the tarot trumps that remains within the most packs of playing cards. because it's the jester. It's the wild card that can, in some card games, it can be a very high value card or it can be a very low value card. Now in the image of the template I've given you, it's got a particular place on the Tree of Life, but actually the fool could crop up anywhere. Because the fool, in a sense, the Goethe is sometimes called the green fool, the pure fool, represents that newness of life energy, greenness. Ancient Egyptians represented this quality with the figure of the god Osiris, whose image we got at the center of the circle. Osiris is the god who is dead and ever living. He's the barley god. He's constantly sprouting. He brings opposites together, constantly creating new life out of death. Very mysterious kind of figure somewhere. At his feet is the image of the Ankh, which is the Egyptian symbol of life. It's an interesting symbol, the Ankh, because it all can represent a sandal strap, because it represents motion, movement. And in a sense, that aspect of ourselves that is the fool, when we touch into it, is both completely still and unmoving and constantly moving. So I guess what I'm saying to you is that at your deepest there is this quality that's like the fool of the tarot card, that's like the god Osiris, that has the capacity to renew everything, to renew yourself. But that act of renewal involves quite a lot of what can be perceived as chaos. In ancient Egypt, the act of renewal comes through the inundation of the Nile, where the Nile bursts its banks, and so the things get very muddied up. It becomes a muddy field. All this extraordinary black silt from the mountains of Africa come pouring down into the Nile basin. A lot of the old temples that you see on the banks of the Nile in the days of the inundation would be flooded. They would, because the Nile would flow into them. And so that act of being made new is, at the time when it's happening, may just feel like chaos, may feel like a retrograde step. But it is a necessary disarrangement in order for something new to emerge. So I want to come to the image of the Kabbalistic Tree of Life and to look at something I've called the three steps of the fool. Footsteps of the fool. because in a sense, though it looks like a vertical diagram as I've got it on the board and as it appears on paper, but actually it's an image of going into depth. The bit that's on the bottom of the diagram is the outermost, the bit at the top is the innermost. So if we can think of it at that as a diagram of depth represented in a sort of two-dimensional way. It's a three-dimensional image presented two-dimensionally, but it's really about depth.
What's that say at the bottom there?
It says klipot, which is the Kabbalistic word for fragments and shells. Klipot, shells, fragments. It's shells and fragments being a translation of the word klipot. And in a sense, klipot is where we start from, where human beings begin. We begin in the sense of chaos and of a world without meaning, a world that is fragmentary. Also, the world where everything is somebody else's fault, but where I don't have any, and where I don't have any sense. I don't have much sense of myself as a present, aware being. I have a sense of myself as object, so I am object and the world is full of objects. There's not much sense of subject or subjectivity. It is this world that we've certainly seen surging up with a worldwide populism at the moment, where the desire is that something is wrong and it's somebody else's fault or somebody else will give us a solution. Right, so it's a world without coherence, and in a way it's sort of shocking in a sense to see it in action as we do in our world at the moment, I think. But it's important to kind of understand it in a sense, that because actually a lot of the time you find yourself thinking, well, that's just stupid, that doesn't make any sense, and of course it doesn't, because it's a world of incoherence, a world of fragments. It's not going to make sense, and the sense that is made of it, or the cohesion that is made of it, is by those fragments uniting around another object, either a good object in the sense of the great leader who will save us, or the bad object who is the enemy who is causing it all. So that place of incoherence, this is the Kabbalists spend a lot of time looking at the things that go wrong, at the energies of incoherence, the energies of disturbance, and you know, we all have this part inside ourselves, this place where we kind of blame ourselves, blame the other, look outside ourselves for health and life. And so we all have, to varying degrees, some of this incoherence, some of this objectification operating in us. But at its worst, when it's at its worst, all you perceive, imagine all this is still there, but not visible to the person themselves. If you're operating at this first level, you have no sense of depth. There isn't a sense of anything underneath, because it's all in front of you, and it's all. And so what you have to do is find coherence, find meaning within the fragments. So, and the problem with fragments is, of course, they never hold, because they're not coherent. In their very nature, they're incoherent. So you have to keep reinforcing them. Which is why, if you look at populist political or religious movements, you will find a lot of ecstatic kind of chanting, a lot of sloganeering, because you're having to constantly prop up something that by its own, or even by its own very nature, is incoherent and likely to fall apart. So you have to create, so there's a lot of momentum involved in keeping the faith. And if you relax the momentum, what starts to happen is you start to doubt it, because actually the thing starts to fall apart. So if we're going to kind of cooperate in a sense with that sense of life, that sense of depth that's trying to emerge in us, the first step that has to be taken is to step through that field of incoherence, that field of objectification, into some at least primitive sense of presence and subjectivity. At its most basic, just a sense of your body in present time. It's a sad fact, really, but a true fact, that most people have very little sense of their bodies. You know, obviously they live in their bodies, and they, but actually what they're living in is a field of fragmentation, which so I think it's like road rage incidents happen. What on earth does it, people can kill people over some stupidest thing in the car. Why can they do that? It's because they're so overwhelmed by whatever the kind of fragmentary rage or stuff is that they don't have literally don't have control in the moment over their actions. Obviously, when people drink as well, that also inhibits that and also aids and abets that. But the fundamental problem really is the inability to, even at a very primitive level, to sense your body. You know, because if you think of things like road rage, what happens there is, okay, somebody's cut you up maybe and done something that's made you angry, and you lose all normal sense of context, all normal sense of moderation. They become the enemy, the person who has to be destroyed in order to restore your equilibrium. So, people are capable of remarkable things terrible things, but remarkable things. And in that moment, people can kill people without any normal sense of that they're killing somebody.
So is this instinctive behaviour? Because you you cut me up.
Well, I think it's not. I think it isn't actually. I think it's because if we talk the instinct of the body, because the body has a sense of self-preservation in it as well. The problem with these, it isn't so much instinctive. It's that kind of. It is created. It will feel instinctive to the person in that moment, but it actually isn't based upon the body's reflexes. Because when you're present in the body, you also have a sense of the vulnerability of the body. And people don't. They're actually not much sensing their body. They're sort of in this kind of generated rage, which will, it'll have all kinds of antecedents in it from the people. But they're not even aware quite of what their bodies are doing in that moment. And and classically, if you read accounts of these things, people talk about coming to later. I saw red, or the mist came down, or there's various ways of describing what happens. But it's a powerful, this like clipotic aspect of human nature, this fragmentary aspect of human nature is very powerful, and it is that which gets, which mass movements kind of draw upon in order to harness kind of, very powerful collective energies. And, which is why it's predominant, the predominant nature of that clipotic thing is it's something that's very, very unstable, that's trying to find meaning and can only find meaning in further objectification, further spinning out.
So where does it go in the sense that you're talking about this movement? It seems to be getting now crazier and crazier.
Yeah, totally.
What happens?
Well, God knows. I mean, that's the scary. This is the scary moment of our time, isn't it? I mean, one of the things, certainly one of the things you can see it's doing politically is putting extraordinary people into power. So the rest of us, those who aren't in that, sit back thinking, oh my God, oh my God, how can this be? So that energy of incoherence, that energy that has temporarily collected around somebody, empowers that person and push and does extraordinary mad things. I mean, it's and the Great American Satirical Cartoon Play programs did a program once. I can't remember the name of it now, but which one was it? Anyway, it did a satirical program of 10 years ago about one of the main characters becoming president after Donald Trump had become president and had bankrupted America. You know, and this was so far, it was a very satirical idea, so beyond possibility that it was hilarious.
I think it was American Guy.
American Guy, could well have been American Guy, yes. So there's So something that was a cart, something I remember watching it and laughing at it, and something that was a cartoon madness, so these mad things that can come into actuality. I mean, it is, of course, you know, what Farrell, the Third Reich, and you know, and what you saw happening there when it had taken to its logical end is total destruction, really, and in the end, the destruction of the Nazis even themselves, because there's no health in that. It's ultimately a destructive energy that keeps on having to consume whatever is around it.
It does seem very necessary, though. You spoke about a necessary disruption as
yes.
part of the fool.
That's right, yes. That's right.
Fools are required as yeah. leaders now because they generate the necessary disruption. They generate the chaos that is required for things to change.
That's right. So I think that's if we sit back in this and look at from a deeper level, we're looking at, you know, we're seeing something very disruptive that's happening. And we live, of course, in a time that needs disruption in lots of ways. Actually, you know, if we look at the climate emergency, we look at the way the world is, the sort of it, the neoliberal order isn't up to meeting that. So I think that there's this whole mysterious thing sometimes where you have to trust the deep process that's going on underneath everything, which is challenging, and we're going to look at how to do that this weekend. But to look at the end, even these things that just feel completely unimaginable, somewhere in their own distorted way are connected to something deeper that's trying to emerge.
A long way from the disruption of Mo Molem going into the maze, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's the fool causing disruption, but there's a
will. No, that's a quite a different thing. She's consciously working with that idea, you know, and in a sense this is a woman of extraordinary integrity and kind of ability, you know, and so that's a different so the, you know, she's not, you know, she's not Trump, she's somebody working consciously with presence, with that energy of disruption. Still a full class, she's still absolutely working with that energy and kind of doing it consciously, doing it, I think, I've my opinion, with compassion and awareness and sort of and that's a different thing. So to come back to the footsteps of the fool for a moment, the very first footstep really is the step into at least the presence of what's happening in your body. So to discover you are embodied. It sounds obvious, but actually when you pay attention, you will discover, at least I discover quite often, that I'm not embodied. I'm just thinking. Sometimes I'm resentfully brooding and kind of hating, and sometimes I'm thinking nice thoughts, but you know, it depends on the day. And in those moments, I don't have a much sense of my body. Because what happens, but that in itself is interesting, because even as we start even to get a little bit of a handle on embodiment, we start to discover subjectivity. And we start to discover agency. Now in the tarot pack, the first path you encounter, right at the bottom here, you've entered the kingdom of your own body, really, and then you have card number 20, you have card number 21, the universe. Let's find the universe for a moment in here. It's the last of the major trumps.
So who's the universe?
It joins Malchut to Yesod right at the bottom. It's in small letters, just at the bottom.
It's in blue,
so it's not so easy to read. Not so easy to read, but I'll just. There we go. In the Rider-Waite pack, it's this card. It's the woman dancing with a snake in the Thoth pack. It's this card in the, if you've got the Thoth pack, it's this card. So it's these two, either one of these. Yeah. Now, what this card and what this thing represents is entering into the universe, entering into the subjective universe, we could say, or the more fluid universe, the place where things are less shaped. So you've got the image of a woman dancing in the Thoth pack. She's dancing with this great snake. In the Rider-Waite, she's dancing and holding wands and has this kind of flowing scarf around her. So the image suggests movement, it suggests possibility, change. We've got the images of the four holy living creatures in the corners of both cards, which hold that sense of the temple, the space that is contemplative. We've got this kind of oval kind of wreath or oval boundary, which kind of defines in a way our own inner universe and the inner aspect of the universe.
The world, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we're entering the world, we're entering the universe, we're engaging with, but we start then to engage with movement. Now, if we come back to my diagram. What we start to do, as we have stepped from the world of fragmentation, we come into a sense of embodiment, and then we encounter what I've called the triad of personality, which is a combination of thought, feeling, and image. So as we touch into the subjective universe, what we start through embodiment, and we could draw lines connecting the body to those places, we then start to come into relationship with movement, with things combining together to create meaning, to create stability. And in particular, the first thing you will start to notice when you do this is an interior, a constant subliminal interior dialogue that is continually commenting, describing yourself, describing the world that you're in. And that movement between thought, feeling, image is of course being impacted on by anything that's coming at us from the senses or anything that we're encountering in outer life. So there is a constant sort of dialogue going on that as long as we maintain some sense of embodiment, we can create a space that enables us to see that dialogue as linked to but separate from the events that are outside us in the world. Yeah. As long as we retain a sense of embodiment, some sense of embodiment, we are able to create a space between whatever is going on in us subjectively and what's going on outside us. When we lose embodiment, that all mushes up together. which is where we get this world of fragmentation, where things, where external objects and internal objects get mixed up together. But as we create just some sense of space, and as we have a glimpse, really, of the fact that there is an internal universe, we're then still within the sense of the templum, the contemplative space. So we can start to engage with whatever is going on inside us as going on inside us, rather than as necessarily caused by something in the world outside it. In alchemical terms, this is called the creation of the alchemical vessel. Ancient Egyptians would describe this as creating the ship of Ra, creating the vessel in which the illuminating consciousness can operate within.
What was the first one there?
First one of what?
The ship of Ra, but you said before that one.
The alchemical vessel. So it's, you could call it the creation of an alchemical vessel within which can happen. The ancient Egyptian analogue of that, which is the prototype of the alchemical vessel, is this ship in which the sun god travels. Sun god in this sense represents that kind of presence of creative life. So one of the first tasks as we become embodied is to continually re-embody ourselves, to create a container that can withstand the impact of the internal dialogue and outer life, to create a sort of a boundary within which the contemplative work can happen.
So this is all happening in Magath, in
Magath? Yeah. As we keep coming, because what happens literally as you come back into a sense of yourself, into your sense of your body, into your felt sense, you start to find, you can notice what's outside me, what's inside me. At the most primitive kind of level, right, you can just get this sense of, okay, I am feeling. So when we don't have this, we feel upset and angry, and we feel upset and angry because of Boris Johnson. Well, Boris Johnson is going to ruin my life. It is actually possible, but in the moment, it's not a reflective possibility. I know it. Perhaps I start planning to kill Boris, right? Because that would be the only solution. In that moment, in that mixed up place, that's the only solution. You have to act. That's why people do kill people. So assassinations happen. Never assassinations never work as political tools. They just create chaos. But in the moment, for the assassin, they're doing the good thing. You know, one of my astonishing things is I've done a lot of work in Israel, and there was a man called Baruch Goldstein who machine guns in Hebron. His machine guns sort of Muslim worshippers at prayer one Friday, and who was a devout, kind man, Baruch Goldstein, who believed he was doing a good thing. And not only a good thing, the only necessary thing in order to heal the world.
As does ISIS.
No, that's the same idea. Exactly the same idea. Because the only possibility is to act and to get rid of the bad thing. Right, so this apparently simple process of just coming back into the body stops that. Because when you have a sense of presence, a sense of embodiment, it's not that you can't still do terrible things, but you do them knowingly. It's not an unconscious kind of process. So when you do create this boundary, you start to create this vessel, this ship in which your consciousness can travel in a way. It then helps you to start relating to your internal process as process rather than actuality. So if I think about Boris Johnson, it's obviously going to be my metaphor of choice this weekend. I feel disturbed and, I want him not to exist, but I know he exists, and if I stay with it, I can understand why he exists, and he becomes smaller. He becomes smaller, I become less scared, I become more focused in actuality. I even become focused in the actuality he might, the slim possibility he might not become Prime Minister. That's not even a given just yet. So I come into touch with the real, with the present moment, with the interplay of the universe.
Boris Johnson is like here, and
yeah. He receives the more space is created.
Will there be life after Boris Johnson?
There will be. We start to remember that, right? Because actually, when he's up close like that, it feels like there isn't. It's sort of, oh my God. But as we do that, we create space. So he becomes smaller, we become larger.
Isn't that just
being No, not necessarily. I don't access that, I don't access it that way at all. I know you think you do, but I think it's because you've got a strong sense of yourself. No, I don't think it's about being rational. I think sometimes what you call being rational, this is obviously an ongoing conversation between us, is because you have a very strong sense of your own self and a sense of presence, and so you don't go out into that. I've got a much more fluid kind of much more likely to go out into catastrophizing, you know, than you do, because you stay centered much more in yourself. And I think it's because of that rather than because you're thinking it through. I think your mind really helps you to get to that place. You know, we're all different in how do we help the sense of embodiment. I think your ability to think helps you to do that. For me, it isn't. It's actually my connection between mind and feeling is actually much more important to me because what happens to me is I come into my sense of body, I come into a sense of presence, I notice the feeling of disturbance, but I notice it as a feeling of disturbance within me, and I start to settle. I think you do the other thing. I think you go into your mind and you think it through, and something settles in you. And that's the point. We're all different in our configuration here, because what happens is, as we get embodied, we encounter this particular dialogue that is just ours. Now, the way it's said there, you know, all three parts look like they're equal, but actually, normally because of the asymmetry of our brains, some of us are more orientated towards thinking, some are more orientated towards feeling. And so our own particular dialogue has different brakes and different drivers, depending on the shape that we have created. It's a bit like a standing wave. I mean, ourself is like, it has a shape. It's a fluid shape because it's moving all the time. But it has, like a standing wave would. If you look at a wave machine in a pool, you see these things that are just caused by constant motion but have a shape. Now, our dialogue has its own shape. So, and part of what you discover as you get embodied and as you look inward is you discover the shape of your own internal dialogue. Just going to break in a second before we go on, but just stop for a moment, just close your eyes. And just pay attention to your body. Pay attention to your senses. And then just look inward. I'll just be quiet for a few minutes while we just do that. And so what you're going to do now is just to experience your own subjectivity, your own internal dialogue. Don't interfere with it. Just get curious about what happens when you look at it. And then just bring your attention out. What did you discover? What did you see? What happened?
It's quite interesting. Lots of fluttering and what's happening in my stomach. I'm hungry. Mm.
Yeah.
This kind of stuff. Yeah. And then sudden awareness of myself, of the part that was watching that part.
Yes, good.
And then feeling, that's my ground of being, is that.
Yeah. Yeah,
and
good.
Then actually really getting into the body.
Yeah, great,
and
good.
Feeling very happy.
Good, yeah, that's nice. Lovely. Yeah. Now, that's a good illustration of the surface dialogue, and then as you look deeper, you kind of land into presence. Nice. Anybody else?
Really notice the kind of upward downward thing. I think what helped me go in was sensations in my body.
Yeah.
That's, I suppose, the almost like the gateway into it. And then I noticed my breathing. Actually, it's not necessarily breathing that takes me into it.
Yeah.
But I felt a sense of things kind of like settling. And then a thought would come in, and then everything would ping up to the thought.
Yeah.
And then I'd go, go down again.
Yeah, right.
But really notice that ping up and then go down.
Yeah. That's good. Great.
I find some words are very, very helpful. I mean, my experience was of going literally in, so starting with the skin.
Yeah.
And then going inwards. But the word curious, I find it incredibly helpful.
Oh, yeah, right.
To get me into an internal looking thing, there are certain keywords.
Yeah.
So suppose you get a symbol then, because then, of course, I've got a symbol of cauldron.
Yeah.
Because that's what I'm working on now.
Yeah.
But the idea is not to go to those sort of places.
No, you could go. I mean,
actually,
but to connect with your body.
It was all bound up with my intestines. It wasn't just a.
Yeah.
It was.
No. So that's in that case, you follow it. That's, you know. So well, the judgment you have to make is: does whatever would connect to help you to become more present, or does it take you out of presence? You can do that with anything. So that's but generally speaking, when something appears, again, provided you've sort of got some sense of your connection to your body, follow the image and see where it takes you. We're going to do a lot of talking about images and what happens with images just, you know, quite soon, really.
So in a sense, it's as though all these pop-pops, like Fern's talking about, are images where it's a sense of the clip-off, isn't it?
Yeah.
And then moving.
Yeah, and once they and if they connect and if they're brought into connection, then they become not clipotic. They then become fuel. They then become something that increases your sense of presence. The Kabbalists have this idea, important idea of reaching into the fragments to find the lost spark inside them. And so this idea is so that as you find the thoughts, you don't. Because if you get angry with yourself for having a thought, which Fern didn't do, you then spin out, so that you become more fragmented. Whereas if you just notice, what happened, you're in a sense holding the form within the containment of your awareness. Then it dissolves and becomes energy, and actually deepens your sense of connection. So that's a very important principle, really.
That thing was held away. Maintain my
integrity while also being part of everything, not losing shape.
Yeah. That's absolutely the territory, isn't it? Because it's about creating a container that is permeable, that does connect, but that doesn't dissolve. So that there's a need for that, for containment that connects. You know, if you look at the cell walls, if we had no cell walls, our bodies would dissolve into mush. But our cell walls are these defined but completely permeable things that allow constant interchange of all kinds of things. So we're seeking to create a shape that has the capacity to connect and allow interchange, but that doesn't lose its shape. Okay, let's stop and have a cup of tea or a loo break just for a quarter of an hour.